Welcome to episode 3 of Thinking Habits podcast. Slightly weird intro this afternoon because I'm not sat in my usual desk spot. I'm actually stood in Ambleside by Great Langdale in a campsite. Absolutely stunning view. I'll post a picture up of where we are. We bought a bell tent from a friend of ours a few years ago, and we've just never had a chance to use it, so we decided this weekend we'd go with friends Kelly and Alex and go and pitch it up and see what it looked like. Only took us 20 minutes to put it up as well. It was great, really easy to do. Thanks to Yvette for organising that bell tent for us so many years ago, and just a shame we haven't had a chance to use it till now. But I'm just staring at the hills and the blue sky at the minute, and it's just stunning. There's just the sound of sheep and birds, and there's some birds of prey in the distance. I don't know whether they're buzzards or goshawks or whatever. I mean, it's too far away, I can't tell. If anybody knows what the local birds of prey are, please do let me know. So this week, it's going to be an interesting episode. It's kind of a reflective episode because last week was a bit hardcore for me, but it finished on a note where I talked about how I feel that I am the kind of person who needs medication. And no sooner had I put it up, but I read an article that was discussing Johan Hari's new book about how that whole chemical imbalance thing is incorrect, and that we are being fed lies by the, you know, big pharma and whatnot. I've, you know, as a mental health nurse, I've looked into a fair amount of research into medication, you know, for my own personal interest, given the fact that I take it all the time, but also because, you know, I have to advocate for that for other people. And it's difficult for me to really form an objective opinion, given the fact that I take it and it works for me. But bottom line, it works for me. And this is going to be a podcast intro. The main part of the podcast will be recorded tomorrow. I think my opinion on what Johan Hari is saying is that the big pharma is selling us the what we need to hear in order to sell more medication, and what we should be doing is looking elsewhere for our mental health and our mental well-being. Well, my answer to that is no shit. Of course we are. Any good doctor worth his salt will not give you medication as a be-all and end-all. Be-all and end-all is, it has to be a holistic thing. It has to be something that is that encompasses all of your life. At the end of the day, you can medicate for pretty much anything, but unless you're looking at your lifestyle as well, you've got to look at things you've got to not look at things in isolation. And I think the fact that he is using that kind of shock tactic to sell books is a little bit cynical for me. Let's be clear, full disclosure, I've not read the whole book. I've read a few articles, I've read a few people in support of his stuff, and I've read a few people against his stuff. My personal opinion is that the way that he discusses medication in his articles is cynical. I don't think he acknowledges fully that the fact is that most decent medical practitioners will be looking at medication as part of a holistic solution and not the whole of it. And I don't think he has gone into enough detail from a wide enough range of sources to see that certain people, not 100% of people by any stretch, certain people need those medications. Medically need those medications. And yes, there is an absolute understanding that large pharmaceutical industries will use positive feedback and positive results to sell more medication, but that doesn't invalidate their effectiveness in some people. I know from bitter experience over 15 years regardless of how healthy, fit, positive, relaxed, you know, if my job is good, my home life is good, my, you know, I've got no financial worries. I've been in a position where I have no worries whatsoever, and I've decided that I'm going to come off my meds. And no sooner do I do that, within a month, I relapse, and I relapse hard, because I, you know, I really struggle with maintaining that balance, and that may be because of psychosocial symptoms that I am yet to understand. But until I understand that, or until I'm prepared to, until I'm in a position where I can explore that further, or I get some evidence that really proves to me that is the case, I've tried everything. I've tried diet, I've tried meditation, keep fit, and I do all those things, you know, I still do all those things, I maintain all of those things. But what works for me is that and medication. And I think that the shock tactics he's using, which are encouraging people to just stop taking their meds, is incredibly dangerous for some people. And I think the problem is as well that there are some medications that you really do not just stop. The rebound symptoms and the rebound depression and sometimes psychosis that you can get from doing that is absolutely dreadful. And I think it's a very irresponsible way to market your opinions. No disrespect to him. I think he's a good author. I think he's a good writer, and I think he researches his stuff. And you know, he's been under a bit of pressure recently for certain articles which got him into trouble. But you know, he's paid his dues for that, and he held his hands up. But I think what this Sunday's podcast aims to do is look at what he's written, look at the evidence on either side, and then I will form my own opinion, which, you know, I'm recording this intro now before I've recorded the bits that I've already researched. But you know, I'm laying my cards on the table. I'm more than willing to be proven wrong, more than willing, because I don't want to take medication forever. You know, I don't, you know, I there was a post on Facebook a few months ago. It comes up every now and again, and it's a picture. It's split in two halves. The first half, the top half, is tablets, and the bottom half is a view, not dissimilar to what I'm looking at now. And it's the other way around. The top view's the mountains, and the bottom view's the tablets. And the top view says this is an antidepressant, and the bottom view says this is shit. And it implies that the medication is rubbish, and the view, or being outside, is the antidepressant. I fully agree that being outside is an antidepressant. I'm totally on board with that. I feel more chill than I've done in days just by being outside, just by walking around this beautiful countryside. But that is irresponsible to say that it's, you know, to rule things out offhand without understanding why people take what they take. You know. Yes, we live in a culture where people are perceived to be over-medicated, but the problem is that for those people that are over-medicated, there are two or three people who are medicated for a reason and who need it. It's irresponsible to think otherwise. So it'd be interesting to see what comes of this. I'm always interested in hearing people's opinions, but I thought it'd be nice to do an intro in the middle of nowhere. Because it's pretty. So, I'll be doing a little bit more considered research when I get back. Although it's incredibly tempting to just stay here because it's really nice. Hopefully you'll enjoy what I've put together. I'm hoping to get another couple of guests in the next couple of weeks. I've had a couple of people who really want to come on, which is really encouraging. And I had some really nice messages about my last week's podcast, because like I say, it was ripping off quite a big band-aid. It's not something I haven't talked about before, but it is something that I haven't talked about in such a public forum. But again, you know, if I can't do that, then what's in it for anybody else to be able to do the same thing? So I hope to lead by example. So hopefully enjoy the podcast, and I'll come in with my closing comments at the end. Episode 3. Welcome. Episode 3 of the Thinking Habits podcast. Sat here on a beautiful, beautiful Sunday morning. I actually recorded an intro outside for this podcast on Friday afternoon. We went camping with two very good friends of ours, Kelly and Alex, Pam and I. We went camping in Langdale. It's near Ambleside in the Lake District. We stayed at this lovely little campsite in a tiny little village called Chapel Style, and it's a place called Baysbrown Farm. Highly recommend it to anybody. The views were absolutely stunning. It was really nice to get out in the fresh air, and I thought it would be a nice idea to do a bit of kind of guerrilla podcasting out in the open air. The problem with that podcast intro was that I kind of went off a bit into the topic that I was going to talk about without actually having all the stuff with me. But I want to address this particular subject properly. So today's episode is kind of it's mainly about medication for a variety of reasons. But before we get into that, I think it's important to address the fact that there's been two very high-profile recent deaths in the media. Kate Spade, the fashion designer, and more recently Anthony Bourdain, the chef and broadcaster. Now, I kind of feel like I've missed a cultural zeitgeist a bit, because I know of Anthony Bourdain and I know of his stuff and I know that he's very highly regarded, but I've never really kind of followed him in any particular way. However, I am very struck by the fact that a lot of my close friends were, and similarly Kate Spade, and it's very apparent when people in the media die, whether it be David Bowie or Robin Williams or Anthony Bourdain or Kurt Cobain, you know. And I was looking into this a little bit. There's quite a lot on the internet about it, and the best explanation that I heard about this is described as parasocial interactions. There was a Vice article where they talked about, they asked a therapist about why we grieve celebrities like we knew them, and it's suggested that parasocial interactions resemble face-to-face interactions in terms of the way we feel about them, except they're one-sided. We develop a certain intimacy with people that we follow and we idolise, and they affect our lives in a number of different ways. They give us things to talk about. They give us things to boost us. You know, I have a playlist that I listen to when I'm feeling really, you know, anxious or down, and it never fails to lift me up. You know, you make connections either consciously or subconsciously with a lot of social media and a lot of different aspects of your life, and these things can become incredibly ingrained and important, and that's why these relationships can be as important to you as family and friends, and that's why there has to be a period of mourning, because you do go through a period of having to adjust to the fact that those influences in real time are not going to be around, and that's why often there's that explosion of grief, and we have to go through the grieving process in the same way as we would any other way, and it's desperately sad. It's always very, very sad when anybody, you know, in the media takes their life. But I think it's also important to address the fact that we're still using phrases like committed suicide, and I think that's it's important to address. I still do it. It's a habit that I'm trying to break. Committed suicide is just, you know, it's like Hoover instead of vacuum. It's just one of those things that's so ingrained. But I think it's important to look at these things, not, you know, it would be very easy to dismiss that as being a bit overly sensitive. But I think it's very important to address that committing suicide harks back, that language harks back to the fact that at one point suicide was illegal. Committing murder, committing suicide, it's the same, it's from that same etymology. So we need to be looking at that, and a lot of mental health charities and mental health foundations are
advocating that we use a different language. We use a different language, such as ended their life by suicide, died by suicide, or completed suicide. Now, the argument in favour of that is it reduces the stigma and it makes it easier to talk about. Suicide needs to be easier to talk about. It needs to be easier to address because it's not going away. It's still around, and if you continue to lump it into taboos and previously illegal acts, it's not helpful. It's not helpful. And certain news outlets are becoming more in tune to this and are being more sensitive about how they address that, but it's still not perfect yet. And I think once again it's very important at this point to stress that there are people you can talk to. On social media, there's websites like the Blurt Foundation, which is really just encouraging open dialogue about mental illness. You've got Mind, you've got Sane, you've got the Samaritans, who can be contacted on 116123. At any point, you can call them, you can text them. The text option is brilliant for people who have severe anxiety issues, because you might not want to speak to somebody. It's sometimes that even that idea puts people off. I've used the Samaritans before, once or twice when I've been in a real pickle, and they were brilliant, absolutely brilliant, staffed by volunteers, just there to listen. They're not there to opine, they're not there to tell you to do things, they're just there to listen. And what it did for me was it enabled me to use that time, those 10-15 minutes, just to empty the stuff that was in my head, because once it's out, once you vomit that stuff out, it's there, and you can pick at the bits that will help you make sense of it. It worked for me. There's lots of different ways. Social media is wonderful in as many ways as it's dreadful. It is really wonderful in the fact that there are phenomenally supportive and positive groups that will help by just listening, by just being there. So I'll post some links again about that. But again, it's always so sad when you read these news stories and coming back from camping. Actually, funnily enough, linking back into that, Kelly and Alex, who Pam and I travelled with, they were huge fans of Anthony Bourdain, and understanding. It's kind of odd because when people like sort of Robin Williams died and David Bowie died, and I felt like I had more of a tangible connection to that, whereas this felt a little bit more intangible. So from an outsider's point of view, it was noteworthy to see the reaction in others that I couldn't necessarily empathise with myself. Well, I can empathise with it, but I wasn't necessarily experiencing that myself for this particular person, and that was very interesting. And if anybody wants to talk about that, about how these things have affected them, or other bereavements, whether they be public or private, there is an opportunity to talk about that either to me or to somebody else. So today the main focus of the podcast is going to be about medication. There's a reason for that. When I did the episode last week, which again I must thank everybody for their very, very kind feedback, I talk at the end of that podcast about how I feel medication works for me, and I think it's important for me to reiterate where I'm coming from before we get into the main discussion. But I've been on medication for anxiety and depression, specifically SSRIs for anxiety and depression, for 18 years on and off. Now, they originally started me when I first went to the doctors for symptoms of anxiety. They actually originally started me on a tricyclic antidepressant, which was an old-fashioned one. And it's important for me to note that that particular one was not good for me at all. I lasted about 3 weeks on that, and I was getting the most horrific panic attacks. I couldn't even leave the house. And as soon as I stopped that particular medication, they went away. They literally within, I would say, 5 days, because those older tricyclics didn't necessarily have what the SSRIs do in terms of building up a therapeutic dose. What you often find with SSRIs is that you need to take them for between 2 and 6 weeks before you start noticing a significant change in your mood as a result of the medication. But again, we're going to get into this a little bit further. It's just to say that for me, medications work. But medications do not work in isolation, and that's where I'm coming from. So no sooner had I uploaded the podcast, but I linked to just doing some googling for future episodes. I linked to an article by Johan Hari, which came out in January, and it kind of passed me by, about his new book, which discusses the fact that, according to his theories, the idea that antidepressant medication works is a result of pharmaceutical spin, a need to sell medication as opposed to real efficacy. Now that jarred with me instantly. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that there are many medications that don't necessarily work as well as you'd expect them to, and not all medications are 100% effective. Well, there's no medication that's 100% effective. But what worried me about this article when I read it was that it was very, it felt very one-sided. But at the same time, I'm 18 years down the line with a variety of different pharmaceutical and non-pharmaceutical therapies for my depression, anxiety, OCD, and whatnot. So I felt it was important for me to sort of take a step back, read the article, read the counterpoints, look at the research again, and see where we're at. Because, you know, I am more than willing to change my mind about medication. If it means that I don't have to take meds anymore and there's something else that I can be doing that I'm not currently doing, sign me up. Because, you know, I don't enjoy having to take meds all the time. I don't particularly want to stay in remission from these symptoms when I could be doing something that would get rid of them. Obviously, of course I don't. You know, I'm not a masochist. So it's very important for me to look at this article with a kind of fresh set of eyes. So my first reaction to the article was that it really bothered me. Not just the fact that he was saying that medications don't work any better than placebos, but the language that he uses is, I think, personally, dangerous. Now, he does make some good points, and I'm going to quote from the Vox article, which is an abridged version, but it's an article written by him based on what the findings in his book. And I should be clear that I haven't read the whole book. I've read widely around it, but the article itself that I've read is by him, and he's espousing the main themes in his book. So I'm not cherry picking. I'm taking this article and analysing it from that. So we'll be talking about the article rather than the book. But he says here, the studies that most strongly support chemical antidepressants found that some 37% of people taking them experience a significant shift in their Hamilton scores, which is a depression inventory score where you can grade your depression depending on your answers to a series of questions. Hamilton scores amounting to a full remission in their symptoms. When therapy and other interventions were added in addition to or in place of these drugs in treatment-resistant cases, remission rates went higher. Yet other scholars looking at the same exact data set noticed that over the long term, fewer than 10% of patients in the study who were incidentally receiving more support than the average depressed American would receive from their doctor experienced complete remission that lasted as long as a year. When I read this, I noticed to my surprise that it fit very closely with my own experience. I had a big initial boost, but then eventually the depression came back. I thought I was weird for sinking back into depression despite taking these drugs, but it turned out I was quite normal. Now, first of all, it says here, yet other scholars. Which scholars? He doesn't mention that, but that's fine because there may be references that I've missed. So we'll take that as read for now. So he talks about this. So first of all, what I get from this is that this article already starts to sound like he has already got a conclusion, and he is using the interviews and the documentation and the evidence that he's found to support his conclusion. Now, it may well be that that's purely, he's trying to remove the null hypothesis. He may well be doing that. I don't get that from this at all. I get this as a very one-sided piece. He then goes on to say, is there a type of depression utterly unconnected to life circumstances? And it says here, and I quote, as I absorbed all this evidence over 3 years, a persistent question kept coming to me. Yes, there are deep causes of depression, but what about people who have nothing to be unhappy about yet still feel deep despair? And there is a debate among scientists about whether there is something called endogenous depression, a form of despair that is triggered purely by biology. The most detailed research into this by George Brown of the Institute of Psychiatry and his colleague Tyrrell Harris in the 70s found that people diagnosed with this problem in fact had just as many life challenges as people whose depression was supposed to be a response to life events. They'd spent years studying how long-term stress can radically increase depression. This could mean that endogenous depression does not exist, or it could mean that the scientists were not good at spotting the difference back then. No. Not at all. It can absolutely mean that endogenous depression exists. Again, it feels like you're taking one side of the argument and you're using it to reinforce your case. There's nothing in that statement, in any of those words, that says to me that endogenous depression doesn't exist. And what's also quite annoying about the way that this has been written is that it implies that it's some kind of revolutionary new thinking and knowledge that medication shouldn't be, should at the very least not be given in isolation. It should be given as a result of a combined therapy. No shit. Of course it should. Absolutely. Any good doctor worth their salt will give you medication if they feel that you need it, but they will, it's certainly in my experience, both personally and professionally, it's never given in isolation. We talk about when I went to the doctor, it was you start these medications, you go for counselling, we look at your diet, we look at your alcohol intake, we look at how much coffee you're drinking, we look at your work circumstances, we take that as a whole, as a holistic package, and we look at making changes. Again, going back to episode one, when I first started this podcast, I talk about the fact that I speak a lot in metaphor. I've never seen SSRIs or any kind of medication as a panacea. It does not fix everything. The way I see it is, if I'm stuck down the well and I am really, really fucked up in my depression, medication doesn't pull me out of the well. All it does is give me the flashlight so I can see the ladder on the wall. I have to do some work. I have to make changes to address the things that are causing my depression. But my point is that I need that lift. My brain, and I've come to this conclusion personally through anecdotal evidence that I've experienced with myself, with other patients, with doctors, psychiatrists, therapists, any number of people, that for some people, myself, and I include myself in this, it is necessary. Anyway, that's where I come from. So we'll read some evidence from another professional. Dean Burnett wrote in The Guardian about this particular article, and I think he articulates it better than me. Obviously, I've got my own opinions in this piece, and it's going to sound a little bit like a bit of a stream of consciousness. But I would like people to draw their own conclusions. I'm not telling anybody what to do in this podcast, so please bear that in mind. But Dean Burnett, Doctor of Neuroscience, he's a comedy writer, he's also a stand-up, and he tutors and lectures at Cardiff University. He's also the author of a book called The Idiot Brain, which is available at all good bookshops, about what the brain, you know, how the brain works in unusual ways. And his comments really rang true for me. He says, the claim that depression is purely the result of lowered serotonin levels is indeed one that can and should be challenged. Antidepressant use isn't effective for everyone, and even if you're taking them, the problem they're supposed to be addressing can often return or eventually get worse. External factors in your life can be a big part, if not the main part, of an eventual depression diagnosis. This is all true, and you know, I 100% agree with that. However, Dean goes on to say, despite Hari's prose suggesting he's uncovered numerous relations, pretty much everything he reveals is well known already. And this is, as I said before, this is my problem. He's not uncovering the Holy Grail. He is rehashing what is already known, and that's what bothers me. And then there's another piece where Hari says, all over the world, doctors were being encouraged to tell patients that depression is, in fact, the result of a spontaneous chemical imbalance in your brain. It is produced by low serotonin or a natural lack of some other chemical. It's not caused by your life. It's caused by your broken brain. I can state categorically for the record that not once has any doctor ever said that to me. When I've been discussing my depression with healthcare professionals, they have always talked about me as a whole, as a person, and talking about my lifestyle, talking about my exercise, talking about all this, talking about my changes in mood and what affected my mood and what we can do about that to change my mood, whether it's counselling, whether it's exercise, whether it's meds, whatever. The serotonin angle, the reason for the chemical efficacy of antidepressants, depending on what you're taking, that was stuff that I learned when I started mental health nursing, because of my categorical need to unpick things to find out why things operate the way they do. So it was my curiosity and obviously being in university and having to learn these things for my studies is where I found that out. So again, which doctors are we talking about here? Because he's saying all over the world, doctors were being encouraged to tell patients. A good doctor, a good GP, has a better psychosocial relationship with their patients. Yes, of course there's going to be bad doctors. Of course there's going to be people who are, you know, we know full well that there are many doctors who are big pharma shills, and they sell the products that they've been, you know, that they've been paid to do, which is why the rules changed a few years ago in the UK, and you can't, you know, pharmaceutical reps can't, you know, glad hand or be seen to be bribing doctors with free gifts and dinners and all that kind of thing, which they used to be able to do, because it seemed to be unfairly favouring one medication over another. More so nowadays, with the absolute hamstringing of medical budgets in the UK, they would be far less likely to pick anything other than the thing that's going to offer them the most value for money, which is another subject for another podcast, because I think that's even more terrifying, because you've got you're often forced to balance efficacy against affordability, which is a terrifying concept. But again, I need to stress this: I've never been told by a GP the ins and outs of the technical chemical function of what's going on. Now, I could have asked, and I'm pretty sure they would have been able to tell me, but the point is, they're not necessarily going to go route one and tell you all those intricate workings when you're in a state of distress. Why would any doctor do that? If I'm coming in and I'm on my arse because my depression is, it's taken me 3 weeks to go to the doctor because I haven't got out of bed for 2.5 weeks, no doctor worth his salt is going to sit there and start bamboozling you with science. They're going to sit there and they're going to listen, they're going to empathise, and they're going to say, right, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do this. So that simple paragraph on its own made me quite angry, because that is, for my mind, designed just to shock people. And then we get into the fact that more recently there has been a massive study of over 500 other studies together that have proven that SSRIs work. Evidence suggests that for as many as 78% of people, simply taking a pill does not completely erase depression's most insidious symptoms, which can include things like isolating oneself, having disturbing impulses to self-harm, or being so self-critical that it interferes with daily life. But in combination, those drugs have been proven to work. And I'll be posting links to the meta-analysis of those studies at the end of the podcast. Now, Professor Carmine Parianti, spokesperson for the Royal College of Psychiatrists, has said that this meta-analysis finally puts to bed the controversy on antidepressants, clearly showing that these drugs do work in lifting mood and helping most people with depression. Importantly, and this is a real kicker, importantly, the paper analyses unpublished data held by pharmaceutical companies that shows that the funding of studies by these companies does not influence the result, thus confirming the clinical usefulness of these drugs is not affected by pharma-sponsored spin. Now, pharma-sponsored spin will definitely increase sales, but I think that is a really, really powerful piece of information. And I think I'd like to revisit this again. What I wanted this to be was a kind of me dipping my toe back into research and looking at what's out there and what's available for people to read. There's two sides in it that we're looking at here. We're looking at Hari's article, and we're looking at psychiatrists who've gone and doctors who've gone, hang on a minute, this isn't right. And I'm also putting my own personal experience into this. So even as I'm recording this, it's coming across as a little bit disjointed. I'm going to leave it in as it is, because I think it's important for me to revisit this with later on as we go down the line, especially with feedback. But what I get from this is that Hari is very keen to state that pharmacy-sponsored spin is what has put us in this position where we are over-medicated. And I don't disagree with the fact that we're probably over-medicated in a large sense across mental health and physical health for a variety of reasons. Mental health, it is very easy to think that medications are just doled out to keep people functioning. I think, you know, there are certain doctors who would do that. Whether they should still be doctors, that probably needs discussing. And also, they're under an awful lot of pressure to get through clinics understaffed, underfunded. Falling into bad habits is common in all professions, and I think that needs to be understood as well. But what Hari's saying is that there's, what I get from it is that there's a pharmacy induced spin that is forcing people to just be prescribed medication as a, go on, take these and you'll get better because your brain's broken. Now, one, I fundamentally disagree with that, because the evidence, both anecdotally, personally and scientifically, disproves that. And also, the way he writes this book is designed to shock, it's designed to upset, it's designed to make people read it. And for me, that's as bad, if not worse, than the pharmacy-sponsored spin he's trying to deride. And I find that very cynical. I find the article does not encourage me to read the book. I'm going to read the book because, again, I'd like to revisit this topic when I've got myself a little bit more information. But the point of this particular podcast, which I should probably have said at the beginning, is that I've gone 18 years on meds and I know my regime works for me. This article really got my back up. So here's me putting my toe back in and going, right, okay, well, where am I with this article? It's like a thermometer for me. Where am I? How do I feel about it? It makes me angry. It makes me really mad because I feel like this is a really just a cynical ploy to sell books. And the worst thing about it is people are going to stop taking their meds because of this. People are going to read this and think, oh shit, well, there's no point in taking these. Stop taking their meds. For God's sake, if you've read this book or any article that tells you to just stop taking your meds, please do not stop taking your meds. If you want to stop taking your medication, go and speak to your GP. Go and speak to the prescriber and say, I want to stop taking my meds. The consequences of stopping your meds without doing it in a controlled and safe manner could be disastrous. And I speak from personal experience about the dangers of rebound depression. And I've seen, as a nurse, I've seen several cases of rebound psychosis when we're talking about antipsychotic medication. The consequences can prove fatal in certain cases. Not necessarily with SSRIs, I'm not trying to frighten anybody, but the point is, don't just stop taking something that you've been prescribed, because you need to be careful about what you're doing and why you're doing it, and you need to do it in a safe and controlled manner. So that, fundamentally, the two tenets of this article for me are that he's trying to sell his book and he's frightening people, and that is very, very dangerous. And for me, that feels very anti-scientific. I am fully prepared to come back in 6 months' time, read more articles, read the book, and come back with a new hat on and say, actually, do you know what? There's some stuff going on here that I needed to understand, and I am not a person who cannot have their minds changed, but I need to be presented with the evidence, and so far, the evidence that I've looked at, it's not looking good for this particular theory. So make of that what you will, but please be very, very careful if you feel that that's going to be a decision that you want to take. And also, another thing that annoyed me about this article was that he talks about the fact that, you know, changing your lifestyle, changing your job, changing your exercise makes a difference to your mental health. Of course it does. 48 hours camping, I feel absolutely phenomenal. I didn't sleep very well, but I didn't need to. I was well rested, I got loads of vitamin D, I got fresh air, I got to go out in the sunshine, I got to see dragonflies and birds and sheep and, you know, just wonderful nature in all its glory. And that is an incredibly uplifting thing to see. But it's not revelatory science. That just pisses me off, the fact that he can use that as a kind of, it almost feels like he's a snake oil salesman piggybacking off the back of other people, and for me it doesn't really paint him in a very good light. But I've never met the guy. He might be doing this for purely noble reasons, but it doesn't feel like it to me. So I think on that note, because I get the sense that I'm rambling a bit, I'm gonna draw it to a bit of a close. It's important at this point to say that I welcome any feedback, positive or negative. If you agree with the article and you feel strongly, please tell me, because I would like to know more. If you don't, tell me as well. Let's get a debate going, because science moves on. It could be that we're in a position now where we need to look beyond that. We need to look for other solutions, other options. But again, going by this article, he's certainly not espousing anything new, so it would be interesting to see what other people think. In the meantime, again, let me reiterate that there's help if you need it. Go and speak to your GP. Go on the web and talk to people like Mind and the Blurt Foundation. Call the Samaritans on 116 123. Speak to somebody if you're struggling. There is help out there and you are absolutely not alone. So on that note, I'll draw this one to a conclusion. On that note, I'll draw this episode to a conclusion, but I hope it's been interesting listening to me rambling a bit. I think there's no doubt that when it actually does go live, I will have edited it quite a bit. But I hope it was useful. And as ever, keep talking. And if you need to talk, you know where I am. Bye.